They're coming to get you, Barbara. You're still afraid.
Stop it! You're ignorant!
Hello, welcome to Night of the Living Academic Podcast. I'm Caitlin, and I welcome all horror films into my heart with open arms, even the misfit ones.
And this is your co-host, Matt, and I've been called Standards. Including standards for good introductions, Caitlin. Nice stumble. And that's after we repeated it.
I did my best. It was fine.
Well, it was fine. Okay, it was fine. Well, I guess I'm the one with standards.
Oh, my God.
Anyways, horror news before we get into today's episode.
Yes. Well, I guess our horror news, it's more like media we've been watching that right. Is horror or horror adjacent. And I feel like this entire episode is in the adjacent category, including this little media shout out, which is Charlie Kaufman's I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
Yeah, we were almost going to do an episode on that. And honestly, that might have been a little bit more horror adjacent than this movie. I guess we might as well just say this movie, The Devil All the Time. Both of them happens to be recently released Netflix originals. Mm-hmm. Not that it's, I guess Netflix released originals. I never really know how, like, they're not producing it or anything.
I don't think so.
Yeah. But anyways, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, of course, by Charlie Kaufman. Very heady, very, I guess, self-aware and auteur.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it now. I know when we first talked about it, I told you right off the bat, like immediately afterwards, you know, I don't love it now, but I bet you the more I think about it, the more I'm going to be in love with it. And mm-hmm. That's what happened.
All right.
I think it's really a beautiful movie that looking into the mind of who I consider to be pretty close to a genius, as far as you could say that as somebody creating media right now.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I love Charlie Kaufman's other works.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I really thought it was really poignant, and I think it was great. What are your thoughts about that?
I like it better than I thought. Well, I like it better now than I liked it when we first watched it. Because when we first watched it, I just hated it.
Oh, I didn't know you hated it.
Well, it's like, I don't know. It was at least not too boring.
Right.
So I wasn't bored while watching it, but I didn't like it. It felt very purposely pretentious.
Right.
After doing some reading and some research and some thinking about it afterwards, I see how everything makes sense. But I think my main problem with it, oh, by the way, before I get into that, just quickly to mention that it's based on a novel of the same name by Ian Reid. Who is more of like considered a horror or at least a thriller novelist. So, but anyway, I think my biggest problem with it is that it requires so much research after, and I feel like a good movie with a good story shouldn't. And I was also thinking there's so many references to different things, but there were a supreme abundance of references to Rodgers and Hammerstein's musical Oklahoma, right. Which I happen to love, and I know Oklahoma, so I got all those references. But I can't imagine watching this movie without that knowledge of Oklahoma. And I feel like that is ridiculous for a film. I feel like that's a real weak point, because I don't think a movie should require a list of things you need to read right. And watch before even just understanding the story can happen.
I think you're right that this movie sort of demands a syllabus.
Yes.
Not that you need to read it through, but you need to understand some of it. However, I think Charlie Kaufman is one of the few creators who deserves to be as pretentious as he is. Because he's earnest in it.
But it's not even... But then he's I not can't say that's anything. A good movie, then.
I don't think... Well, he's not putting this out there, right? To have all these references. He's not doing it to, like, show that he is wants to impress the viewers mm-hmm. and the audience. He's definitely not doing that. It's just, like, showing how vulnerable he's allowing this piece of media to be
mm-hmm.
by showing that, like, this is me, this is my life and how I interpret things and all the things that impacted me. I'm letting you know there. And there's like a vulnerability there that I think makes it really a special movie because of that. So, yes, part of it is some of the references will help, and like you said, Oklahoma will definitely
that's like number
be
one,
a big impact in understanding, you know, that the story and the characters. It's a major impact on the movie, but mostly, you know, it's there to like say, look, you don't need to know the story, the references, right? Because they have like a 20-minute conversation about this one John Cassavetes movie that we've never watched.
Sure, but that's different from the way that Oklahoma was used.
Yeah,
in this movie, there's a silent ballet that's lifted from Oklahoma. And if you don't know Oklahoma, it's going to feel really weird and jarring. And in fact, it's still pretty weird and jarring. But at least I knew the context of where that ballet is from.
But it's... Well, Oklahoma is sort of a different case because I kind of agree that Oklahoma, because of the character of Judd, it's a little bit more relevant than some of the other references.
Mm-hmm.
But I think mostly it's the idea that, you know, he knows not everybody's going to get the context of it. But the fact that he is aware and almost like he is embarrassed that he wants to put out this without context, knowing that you may not have the context, is... I think just like a really brave move as a filmmaker.
But that's still, so that's fine. I don't think he's trying to be pretentious. I don't think he is pretentious in all these references. I just think it's a poorly constructed narrative in the, like, and I'm not dissing the novel. Because I haven't read it, so I don't know what's going on there. But at least the way the narrative of this film is really poorly constructed because it's probably only going to be enjoyed by like, the 1% of people that have the same cultural references as Charlie Kaufman. And I think that's a failure.
No.
I think film should, like, I don't think it should be like, oh, if you didn't know Oklahoma, then I guess you can't watch and understand this movie.
We talked about it, right? Wondering, like, do we understand the movie? And once we talked about it, without knowing all the references, except for Oklahoma, we realized we understood the movie.
Mm-hmm.
We got it, right? That's what's happening with everybody. We're not special in having this critical thought.
But I really think if I did not see Oklahoma, I don't think I would have gotten it.
I don't necessarily.
I don't think I would have.
We would have gotten the gist of it.
I think I would have turned it off if I hadn't seen Oklahoma.
Well, Oklahoma only became relevant in the last, like, well, you can't really call them acts, but let's say, sorry, the last like 20 minutes or so, right? Last half hour.
No, because it happens at the very beginning, because in the opening drive, they listen to that Many a New Day. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
Many a New Day.
Right, I remember. That's...
And that's where it begins, right from the beginning. There's all this Oklahoma chat.
I'll tell you what, you genre fans can stay on your side of the lane and let the people with standards
gatekeepers.
Not gatekeepers. It's a beautiful movie. I am almost eager to rewatch it.
Oof.
I'm going to put this right up there with Upstream Colors.
This was better than Upstream Colors.
Upstream Colors, and it's... So, you didn't like Upstream Colors more? Because it only had one reference of Walden.
But that one was just boring. This one was at least not boring.
Well, at the very least, we could all agree that for horror fans, they're going to like the dinner scene with Toni Collette.
Yes, the dinner scene, the whole time they're at Jesse Plemons' family home or childhood home.
Right.
Those are the best parts of the
movie. It gets pretty traditional psychological thriller at that point. But, you know, it definitely takes a much more existential approach after that. It was that kind of launched the movie into like existential narratives. Anyways, I kind of did wish we did an episode on it because we'd be arguing the whole time, it seems like.
Yes, I think so.
But we'll stick back to the focus at hand, which is Devil All the Time.
Yes, and I believe you are doing the plot summary today.
Yes, I am, and here I go. Devil All the Time, directed by Antonio Campos. And it was based on a novel of the same name by Donald Ray Pollock, and I would describe it as a Southern Gothic thriller. Using some heavy quotations around the word thriller there. That implies that something thrilling happened. This review is going to have a little bit of my feelings.
You mean the plot summary is going to have some of your feelings.
So the movie, it's got a wide cast of multi-generational characters, and narratively it's structured where we jump in and out of different POVs, but ultimately they all intersect back with arguably the main character, Arvin Russell, who is played by Tom Holland. So as a young boy and a young man, Arvin's life ebbs and flows with various conflicts, sort of like he's Forrest Gump with really shitty and violent luck. So I'm going to just read off here. What's that SNL character, Stefan? We're either going to do a Stefan style, or you could also think of it as a Joe Bob Briggs rundown.
Okay.
So this movie seemingly has everything. You've got cancer-stricken mother, crucified sacrificial dog.
Oh, spoilers, by the way.
Oh, very spoiler-heavy. But people should know at this point. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to start over. We've got a cancer-stricken mother, crucified sacrificial dog, a suicidal religious zealot father, accidentally suicidal, statutorily raped adopted stepsister, a high-pitched, false and horny prophet, a delusional prophet who's also the worst Spider-Man in the multiverse, a remorseful former prostitute turned serial killer bait, a necrophiliac photographer with a god complex, the least scary mob boss in the history of movies, a corrupt and vengeful sheriff, a lovable bodyguard who just wants to eat your leftovers or make you eggs, an overused narrator that provides over-exposition at every single turn, and a soundtrack that never lets you forget this movie takes place in the late 50s. And none of it's interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, your list makes it sound like a very exciting film.
It's not inaccurate,
for the most part. Yeah.
And it's not inaccurate.
Thrilling things do happen, but they're just not presented in a thrilling way.
Yes. So with that, why don't we go ahead and get into our review? Yeah. Let's let you start first.
All right. So yeah, that's pretty much my take on it, that like this movie really could have been good. And I'm curious to read the novel it's based on. Because you said this when we were finished watching the movie, that you could see the novel being really good. Mm-hmm. And I think that's right, because everything that happened should have been exciting. It's all sort of tragic and crime ridden and all the sorts of like pulpy gothic goodness that I normally would really enjoy. But the movie itself, overall, it just felt very flat. And it felt like tragedy after tragedy just kept happening. And like you said, it's all sort of centered around this one character, Arvin, who's mm-hmm. played by Tom Holland. And I think that might have been part of the problem, that it's just like tragedy after tragedy. We never really have time to see the characters deal with any of these tragedies. So it all just sort of feels like, like we don't really have to care because the plot's going to just keep on going. And I think the other issue is that there are so many characters that, like, yeah, we are focused with Tom Holland's character, but there's so many characters that we never really get to know any single one of them or ever really care about them. I think even Tom Holland's character, I didn't really care about him that much, because even him, and he's in this movie most of the time, he's got top billing. I would argue this movie is his character story. But even him, he doesn't come into the movie until 45 minutes into the film.
Yeah.
So like, even the way we get introduced to his character, we're introduced to him through his father. Like, we have to go through his father to get to him. So we never are really just with Tom Holland. It's like seeing this character through other people. So I never really felt like I knew him or cared about him or really anything. So yeah, I think that's what made it feel flat, because I was trying to figure out what did it, because the plot could have been really fun and exciting. I thought the acting was really good.
Yeah.
I definitely was impressed by Tom Holland. I'm always going to be impressed by Robert Pattinson. He made this movie fun. I'm going to say the Robert Pattinson scenes were the scenes I cared about the most, but that's because he was making it really fun. What else? Oh yeah, so I think it's what's to blame is that there's not enough focus on any single character. So I think it's just sort of convoluted, and it just comes off as really flat and like nothing really matters. And yeah, you brought up the narrator. This narrator, the voice of the narrator is actually the writer of the novel, Donald Ray Pollock.
No idea.
So he did the voiceover, And I feel like that definitely sort of killed it. It did give it a Southern vibe. Now, keep in mind, we're both from Long Island, so I have probably a very biased and, like, stereotyped and probably very pop culture based view of what Southern is,
yeah,
in quotes. But it felt very like a Brer Rabbit style, like, yeah, narrator voice. It's like, folks, all right, come on down here. And it's not that intense, but that's how it is in my memory. And he spoiled things. Like, he's like, all right, now that woman, she's going to die in the next scene. Right. And then, yeah, and then she did. And it just felt like, why? Yeah. Just because this is based on a novel, we need a voiceover of the author. So that was sort of frustrating. But, yeah, I don't know. I can't believe we watched the whole movie. It's also over 2 hours long and just sort of flat, as I said. But we made it through the whole thing. I'll stop there.
So I agree with pretty much everything you said, including, you know, Robert Pattinson being the most charismatic character and Tom Holland doing a good job with what he can work with. So the first thing that popped into my head when I'm thinking about this movie was the word soulless. And yes. I want to mention that when you read the Wikipedia article, one of the first, like, things, and, like, you know, when they talk about the movie, it's kind of criticisms of it, and they use the word soulless there, too.
Yeah.
I came up with the word soulless myself, and I'm not saying that to say, like, oh, I was there first. It's just that for such an abstract idea to call a movie soulless, how many people are kind of, like, saying the same thing? And how this movie makes it so immediate that that's the feeling.
Yeah. And that's so, what I think I was getting at with my word flat. Yeah.
And I, like, it's just so, right off, like, you just know there's something, like, completely missing and lacking in this movie. So, like you said, because, you know, like I mentioned, I can see this being a very good book. And, in fact, this type of book is actually my favorite type of book. These kind of multi-generational, like, East of Eden is my favorite novel of all time. I think Middlesex is another good example where we just have this kind of big array of characters where we can dip in and out and they kind of intersect with each other. But that's what this was going for. And, well, I mean, that's what the book probably was. Neither of us read it.
Yeah.
I could see that being supremely interesting. The problem here is this movie takes zero liberty with anything resembling cinematic vision or style. It just came off like as a movie that, you know, I don't know who you want to call the most responsible director, producers. One of the producers, by the way, is Jake Gyllenhaal, I noticed.
Oh, no, Jake.
But it just felt like they were just storyboarding the whole movie with the book and just trying to put the pages of the book onto a movie. And you can't just do that. You can't do that and call it a day. You have to have some sort of cinematic flair or, like, you know, editing or something. And they just somehow turned that into make it the most boring and uninteresting movie possible. I'm, like, truly impressed at how uninteresting this movie is. Knowing all the storylines and the arcs that happen within it. So, I don't know. It was just like this bowl of, like, it's like a boiled chicken with no seasoning. There's, like, there's some sustenance, right, as a vehicle for delivering this plot. And some, you know, pretty intense violence. Maybe not gory violence, but intense violence happens throughout the movie. But it's so bland.
Yeah.
I'd rather be eating, like, something that turned rancid or sour just so I could feel something than just eat this bland boiled chicken of a movie. So it's to the point where, like...
So Jason X is a better film?
Jason X is a better film.
Not that I'm saying it's a rancid film.
So Jason X is a better, I think, better for cinema than this movie is.
Oh, wait, what about Halloween 3?
Halloween 3 is better for cinema. It's more interesting. Okay. There's vision there, and that's the main thing. Like, why are we enlisting all these great actors, all this, like, pretty decent cinematography, I guess, and making a 2-hour movie that costs money and just, like, doing it to just translate a good book into a really pointless, boring piece of movie cinema? Like, that offends me way more than Halloween 3 of someone taking a shot with their bonkers vision and going for something. Maybe it failed for me in particular, but, like, at least they're doing something noteworthy to me. This movie, And it's weird because this movie is not like bad, right? Yeah. In the traditional sense of like, you know,
did everything,
not bad acting. Yeah. I actually think the soundtrack was bad.
I'd agree with
both that. The soundtrack and the original score. Whoever scored this, like, I don't know. That could have made a major impact. It just felt like nothing fit. And it was just, again, uninteresting. But I don't know. I think they needed to redo the script. They needed to do the Coen Brothers treatment where there may be source material, but like they turn that into their own thing.
Yeah.
Right? Even if it does have to take some artistic liberties with the source material, you can't just take exactly what you read and put it. It's to the point where this movie offends me. How blended. I don't know. Yeah. I'm really surprised at how like offended I am about it.
Yeah.
So where should we start when discussing it?
Well, I do want to sort of jump off what you're saying here at the end. First of all, the director actually is the one who wrote the screenplay. So I'm starting to think he might be the one to blame here because he's had an awful lot of control over this film. And then the other thing I wanted to say is just like this idea of adapting a novel into a film. And I totally agree because film and novel are two completely different mediums with completely different like challenges and benefits and things like that. And you need to take advantage of those things and really consider your medium. And I think it's interesting too that we opened this episode talking about I'm thinking of ending things. And again, we didn't read the book, but you know, if you read about I'm Thinking of Ending Things online, you'll see that the book is really different from the film and that Charlie Kaufman really did take a lot of liberties in creating the movie. And I mean, I was sort of being rude about the movie earlier, but I much preferred that to this adaptation of The Devil All the Time, because at least I'm Thinking of Ending Things was made to be a movie.
Right. And I'm Thinking of Ending Things, the book, I'm guessing it's about kind of this underachieving janitor, let's say. Yep. But Charlie Kaufman turned that book into making it about really himself of like this, just this like existential crisis of a neurotic genius.
Yeah.
Right. And well, I guess that actually is maybe close to what the novel is.
But you could tell that it's like, I don't know. I read through the Wikipedia plot summary of the novel and it was at least like the second half had some pretty big changes, it seemed like. And the structure of the way the story was told was changed too a little bit. I feel like that's such an elementary thing too, like so basic that you should know if you're working in film and vice versa, that like your medium, you enjoy working in your medium because it's special. It has its own unique qualities and characteristics that no other medium has. And that's why you like to work in that medium. And I don't know why you wouldn't, like, I guess, respect that. I don't know what the right word, or like, use it to your advantage. Like you were saying, so much money and talent was put into this that it's bizarre that this, I think it's the script, honestly.
Oh, yeah, I definitely think the script and the editing. Mm-hmm. And like, you know what, the Antonio Campos, the director / screenplay writer, by screenplay, he must have just like decided what not to include. Yeah. And that's it. Like, I can't
and
see
that's
him.
That's probably why it's so long, because he probably didn't want to cut out too much from the novel. But a novel you could read, like, across a month.
Yeah. There's just too much. And it's a shame to see what, like, you know, Robin Pattinson coming in.
Yeah. Right?
And, like, probably saying to himself, you know what? I'm just going to make this my own here,
And
too.
He did.
And he did. And that was the most compelling part of the movie. Like, you know, I don't know if the character in a novel is written as this high-pitched preacher, right? False prophet. But he comes off as slimy, and he brought so much life to what was missing for everybody else.
Yeah, and, like, darkness, too. Because if I compare Robert Pattinson's character, because there's a lot of, like, quote-unquote evil, bad characters in this movie. If I compare Robert Pattinson to the serial killers, like, the serial killers felt like, I could probably take him. I could probably get away from him. Whereas Robert Pattinson just felt so sinister in his performance that it felt like a genuine devil all the time. Like a genuine evil person that was uncomfortable and unnerving to sort of watch and be in his orbit.
Yeah.
And Actually, so when I say he made it his own, he truly made it his own. And this might also give us either a peek into Robert Pattinson's method, mm-hmm. or perhaps a peek into this director's method. It seems like Robert Pattinson maybe didn't trust this director that much. Because apparently Robert Pattinson, so in this movie he speaks with a southern accent. The character's supposed to be from Tennessee. Again, we're not from the South, so I can't tell you if this was like an authentic accent. I mean, Robert Pattinson is British, so I don't know if he really knows. And Robert Pattinson said, nope, I'm not going to work with a dialect coach for this for this accent. I'm just going to make it my own. He watched clips of evangelical preachers as well as pop stars from this time period to build both the accent and his character and everything. And he not only didn't work with a dialect coach and just worked himself through this accent, but he also hid his accent work from the director and everyone else on this mm-hmm. film, refused to tell anyone what his accent would sound like, refused to share anything about what he was doing to prepare, and he would only speak in the accent the day they started filming his scene. Mm-hmm. And the reason why IMDb says this, the reason why is Robert Pattinson said he felt sort of insecure about it, and he didn't want the director saying anything against his accent or his character choices until they started filming, because he said he thought he'd have a better chance at keeping what he created, like that it would be harder for the director to change anything if it was the day of filming. So I don't know. I feel like that's a very interesting peek into the creation of this film. I'm glad Robert Pattinson stood strong.
Well, it worked.
It did. It was the best part. And it sounds like he directed himself a little bit
there. Yeah, I think so. And there's two. Robert Pattinson's performance is stand-up performance. And so is Tom Holland. But I think Tom Holland had the luxury of just having more of a character to be fleshed out.
And different from what we've seen him in. I mean, I really only know him from Spider-Man. So seeing him in this more like serious, darker role, that's automatically going to be like surprising and impressive that he has like this range.
But like, let's compare Pattinson's performance. He is a false prophet, horny manipulator. But then there is another, I don't want to call it a false prophet, because this one actually is more of a, he thinks that he's a delusional. He's a delusional prophet. And that just came off as like not bad, but just much more like derivative and rote. Like the director's just like, hey, you know, have you ever watched the movie where you got this fire and brimstone creature coming in? Just do something like that. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what it felt like. And it wasn't bad. No. It just felt like I've seen it hundreds of times, and
it's fine.
It just felt like so derivative.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because I see people celebrating Robert Pattinson's performance and saying it's like very campy, but I wouldn't even call it campy necessarily. Like, I guess that sort of character is campy inherently. Mm-hmm. But I felt like there was so many dimensions to his performance. Like, I'm thinking of the Laz scene. So the scene where Tom Holland confronts Robert Pattinson, and just like watching him realize that Tom Holland, A, has a gun, and B, knows that Robert Pattinson got his stepsister pregnant. I don't know, just like watching his careful veneer of being this holy preacher, watching it like flicker in his face a little bit as we start to see the evil inside. Very good. Whereas, the other one, played by Harry Melling, who is Dudley in the Harry Potter series, it really did feel just like you're saying, just like exactly what you'd expect if you heard like false prophet, evangelical preacher from the South in the 60s. Like, that is what it is. And he, too, well, we also see his mask falter, too, when he murders his wife. I agree. It just felt like I feel like I could do that performance pretty easily. And apparently that guy, so there's a scene in the beginning where Harry Melling, his false prophet, pours a jar of spiders on his head. And apparently those were real spiders, which makes me sort of annoyed that like he did that for this film. And and also made me annoyed because they looked so fake, didn't they? They like looked like CGI spiders to
that
me.
That actually got under my skin when I saw that because they looked like real spiders to me.
Hmm.
Maybe because I just watched a video on like Reddit earlier today of some lady opening up a big egg sack of spiders, which was absolutely disgusting.
Maybe. Because, I mean, I knew beforehand because he was on, Good Morning America, or no, not Good Morning America.
Good Day New York?
Good Day New York. He was on Good Day New York last week talking about this movie, talking about how these were real spiders he poured on his head. So I was very excited to see it, and then it just looked very fake to me.
I don't want to be hard on him, right? Because no. I feel like we should be hard on the director for not giving him a better direction to make it more of something special.
Yeah. Like, yeah, he did. Again, I think all the actors did good here.
I wouldn't even be impressed watching this movie. Like, if this was on HBO, I'd be like, this is not HBO quality. This is like, I don't know, Showtime quality.
Yeah, I guess.
Where they're...
Even then.
They're trying to go for this, like... I think part of what's the problem is they are trying to go for this... What do you call it? Like, high-tier cinema.
Yeah.
Or...
Gritty.
Yeah, gritty. What's it? Prestige television.
Right.
But, like, it doesn't even feel like prestige movies. Prestige television.
But so. Even that, it didn't... I would say, did not succeed. No. I think if this was a TV show on HBO or Showtime, the only good episode would be the Robert Pattinson one.
Pretty much,
I'd say.
Because, I don't know. It's a shame that there's a lot of wasted talent here. Let's talk about... Do you have anything you want to bring up?
No. I mean,
I think for me, the way they approach it is just like talking about each character, what they brought, and like from the performance and stuff. Like we went over, you know, obviously Pattinson and Nelly. I didn't think Bill Skarsgård added anything with
his
performance.
Which stinks because he's usually like a Robert Pattinson. Like I feel like he's another one with pretty natural charisma and usually is a standout.
I don't really think so.
Really? Because I thought he was so good in Castle Rock, and
how I felt about Castle Rock.
In It Chapter 1 and Chapter 2, I'm not a big fan of those movies, but I feel like when we see him without the makeup, those were the shining moments of those movies. And I don't know. I usually like him in this. Yeah, it could have been someone else playing that character. It didn't really feel like... I don't know. It also wasn't that great of a role, I guess. Like, he just had to be angry.
Yeah, I don't even know what they were going for. Like, there's definitely... So, actually, one thing I do want to address. Was there supposed to be a theme of, like, religion?
That's obviously, the devil. So, I have a note here that, like, I think... This movie, again, I can't comment on the novel. I hope the novel's doing something better. But I felt like this movie, another issue is that it was trying to tackle a lot of really broad topics and themes without really saying anything besides, yeah, the world is bad.
Yeah.
And so I think it covers faith and religion and sort of like this extreme religion and how that can be dangerous, and also how there are so many false prophets within religion, how like it allows that to happen. Mm-hmm. I think there's also this whole thing about like inherited trauma, generational anger, because they kept trying to make us like, they had those weird edited parallel shots, I guess, between Tom Holland and what's his name again, Skarsgård, like because Skarsgård is Tom Holland's father, so sometimes they're like, oh, look at Tom Holland bandage his knuckles after he punched someone. Oh, remember 30 minutes ago when Bill Skarsgård
like taught him the
also
same thing.
Did this. Yeah. So they did a little bit of that. And also, like, there's this sense, too, it felt like everyone was treating Tom Holland as, like, oh, you're that boy from that house. Like, oh, you must have some darkness within you. And then also, I thought there's, like, this sense of like, fate and, like, having a lack of agency in your own life. Like, no matter how much Tom Holland tried to fix things, and of course he's fixing things in the way that Skarsgård taught him to, so it's, like, fixing things by fighting. But, like, you know, it should have worked a few times. So he keeps trying to fix things and help people that he loves and cares about. But every time he fixes one thing, something else happens, and it's like this bloodshed sort of and trauma, this cycle that he can't stop. So I think there's something there with that too, that he's like trapped in the system. It's like almost like it does believe in a devil and a god, and like we're all sort of like chess pieces, yeah. I guess, and we're locked into whatever sort of fate we're dealt. Like there's that line in the movie, some people are just born to be buried. And that's sort of what it felt like it was operating on. And at the end, so at the very end, Tom Holland escapes the town, he escapes the two serial killers, and he gets into this VW camper. And it seems like a hippie guy is driving, and he picks up Tom Holland, who's a hitchhiker at this point, and asks where he wants to go. Tom Holland says, like, wherever you're going. I think he's going, I forget where, like Chicago or something. A city, I think. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that neither here nor there. And at the very end of the movie, he's like falling asleep. And you said, oh, I thought that was going to be Charlie Manson or something. Yeah. And it does, it felt really unsettling because this whole movie is like tragedy after tragedy, I guess. I was expecting like the guy to just stab him with a knife and then they're going to click to credits. But it doesn't. But on IMDb, it said that ending purposely was of the director trying to make us think of Charlie Manson. So it was meant to suggest Charles Manson, because that's the same exact, that VW camper is what he drove. So yeah, I think it's just like, again, this like idea of fate, like he's meant to, but I think that's so cheesy too, that we're like going with the number one most famous hippie killer out there. Like, all right, relax.
Well, you would agree too that you're doing the movie a favor and being much more generous with narrowing what whatever themes that the movie portrays.
Sure.
Because the movie did not like
do well, I don't think it's anything. Saying anything. I think it's like, oh, fate is a lie. Isn't that an interesting concept? And that's about all we're saying here.
Yeah. I don't think it was trying to say anything. Like, I think maybe the book was trying to say something.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you capture some of it just by putting it from the page to the movie, but
and not adapting.
But like, not like it still missed it in a really meaningful way, because it's just not a good screenplay. Yeah, not a good script, not a good translation.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't catch any themes from it. Like, I could put my own themes if I wanted to, but like, really, what's the point in doing that, right? Why do this movie a favor like that?
Yeah. And I don't think even that was probably, I mean, I agree, it's not a great script. And I don't think, like, I think even though it's here, I think it probably is coming from the novel, and it's just like watered down subtext or watered down themes, because I don't think the screenplay or the screenwriter is really in, I don't think they were focusing on like the subtext. Yeah. I think they're, like you were saying, I think it's very literal. So I would be interested in seeing the book and seeing...
Honestly, this movie actually did make me want to read the book.
It's sort of like a commercial for the book.
Yeah.
Like a bad commercial for the book.
Exactly. So one thing, let's complain in particular about this narrator.
Okay.
I've never seen a more... So we said, I said at the beginning, this movie doesn't do anything truly that bad. I would say the narrator is bad.
Yeah.
Not the way it was delivered. It was delivered... fine. It was delivered like, remind me of the way Coen Brothers would put in an self-aware narrator that is more of a stylistic choice, and it's more like this kind of throwback to, I don't know, like you said, this folksy type of
southern storytelling,
right.
Or around the campfire or something.
And then the narrator usually has their own agenda or is
connected to a person. Theme or connected to a subtext or something.
Or at the very least, it plays a role of like the Greek chorus.
Yes.
This narrator was just like someone who was reading lines from a book to fill in the gaps in the screenplay.
And I think that's literally what it was since they hired the author to do it. I think what it literally was supposed to be is him writing this book.
They probably didn't even hire him. They probably took clips from an Audible recording he took and just put it in there.
That is what it felt like.
But yeah, I wouldn't go and accuse it of spoiling, right? I
think except for that one scene. Well, that was bad.
I think that was like a choice in editing where it said like, oh, you're not going to see her mama again ever.
But how much more powerful would it have been if we didn't know that was coming? Because it's her own husband killing her like taking her into the woods saying, oh, we're going to pray to God. And then he, the way they shot the murder too was, it felt like it was supposed to be a surprise because he's off screen and all of a sudden he sticks a screwdriver or something into her neck. I feel like that would have been a much more powerful, shocking, maybe even thrilling moment. But because we saw it coming, it's like, why are you even filming like it's supposed to be a surprise right now? Yeah. You told us.
Yeah. That's a good point. That's a good point. That I really can't think of any reason why it wouldn't just be a surprise.
Yeah. I mean, I think they were trying to do like a suspense, like we knew something bad was going to happen. The characters didn't know. So then we're watching the husband with like, you know, we're suspicious of him. So like everything he does is a little unsettling and creepy after that. But then I think they should have done the murder in a different way because it just was like,
they should, yeah. Dumb. Well, they also needed us to care about the characters in the first part. That too. It already failed at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the beginning of the movie was a particularly a mess because of this weird narrative jumps and not letting any scene sit.
Yeah, nothing could breathe.
Yeah, nothing could breathe and no one knows who the characters are. And it was mostly focused on Arvin's father, Bill Skarsgård. Mm-hmm. And even then, it's just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Who are you as a person? You have no idea.
He's an angry vet. That's all we got.
But it's not even like angry either. He's like also kind of charming, but maybe. I don't know if he was necessarily supposed to be dark. It didn't seem like he had his own demons up until, you know, his wife got diagnosed.
Like at the PTSD from that crucified soldier he had to shoot.
Yeah. Well, that was obviously supposed to, they call back to it so many times, but it didn't feel like anything. It didn't feel like.
But I'm just saying, I feel like that was his whole personality, was PTSD vet. Maybe a little charming. But that scene in particular, so there's one scene where the vet, or Skarsgård, I'll call him Skarsgård, he is at a diner, and that's where he meets his future wife. She's a waitress. And then also at the same diner, there's another waitress, and she meets the serial killer, and then they also get married. But the way the narrator did this, it's like in the first 5 minutes of the movie, like we're just getting in here. And they're like, oh, here's Skarsgård. There's his future wife. Oh, and over here is, I don't know, the name, let's say serial killer. And there's his wife. And they're just meeting now, too. Oh, and did you know they're going to call their victims models? And they're going to call their killing photographs, and they're going to collect those photographs.
And then we don't return for another hour. By that point, we forget everything about who they are, or like what is going on. What the hell
it like jumped back to Skarsgård and focused on him for a while. So yeah, I remember being really like startled by this random like reference of a serial killer and his wife and models and photography. Very confusing.
Have you watched any Robert Altman films? Because I could tell, I think they wanted to go for that. And I think this the author might have been, the actual original author might have been inspired by Altman films, which has these kind of very casual encounters between a wide array of characters. It somehow works. He makes it work. It didn't work at all.
I think this could have worked if we just introduced that serial killer couple, knowing we weren't going to come back to them for a while. If they just said something like, Skarsgård didn't know he sat three seats down from a couple that was also just meeting for the first time that would try to kill his son in 20 years. Something like that.
Yeah.
And don't get into the photography and the models. Like, just tell me what I need to know. And, like, that would be like, ooh, I'm interested now. They're going to try to kill his son later?
I mean, I caught everything and I was listening, and I still didn't catch that this was like a serial killer thing.
Yeah, me neither.
I thought it was just like,
why are there models victims?
Yeah. You're just a weird photographer. And it's not even like I'm blaming myself for not understanding that. I think it's just.
It's just weird.
Obscured for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be a big surprise. Like, again, comparing it to I'm Thinking of Ending where everything is obscured, but that's because, like, kind of. Charlie Kaufman's mind is obscured. Mm-hmm. Like, everything's compartmentalized. This is just obscured because it's a bad writing.
Yeah. I'm Thinking of Ending, it's like, it's just throwing us into the mind of Jesse Plemons' character.
Right.
And just, like, not explaining things to us because he wouldn't need things explained to him because it's his own mind.
And then you have a narrator who literally has the power to tell you exactly what's going on. but
whose
doesn't.
Job it is?
Yeah,
to
whose
do
job
that,
it is? And they just use it to not explain the most confusing parts. Of the
yeah,
movie.
But then spoil things or like just directly tell you things we already know. Like sometimes he would come in just to be like, "Oh, Tom Holland, he likes to fight sometimes because his daddy liked to fight. His daddy was in the war. Sometimes he thought about that." Like, okay, thank you. I could look at Tom Holland's sad expression and yeah. his multiple fight scenes against bullies, and I could probably have gotten that, but yeah. thank you.
Or, you know, have, like, dialogue between characters. That yeah. might work, too.
Yeah.
All right.
Or just, yeah, trust the intelligence of your audience a little bit. So, and, yeah.
All right, I want to jump into one. This is the last thing I want to talk about. And okay. it's much of the same we've been talking about, but I just want to point out how extra the worst character I thought was the sheriff.
Yeah.
Played by Sebastian Stan. Call out to your friend Sarah who
yeah.
you were talking to about it, and she says somehow they made Sebastian Stan look ugly.
Yeah.
Which I agree. He looked terrible in this movie.
Yeah, I didn't even recognize him.
Yeah. Most people would know him as Bucky Barnes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, I got no motivation from him. The narrator, again, had to tell us that he did, you know, want some revenge for his sister. Okay, thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Which we actually needed that point, because otherwise we'd had no idea why he actually would care, give a shit about anything.
Right.
He's got this weird, like, completely unnecessary mob side story going
yeah.
on.
Yeah, right? I would have cut that
it
so
had
fast.
Zero implications with anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And it had very minimal implications for just him in general.
Right.
Like, what?
Because he didn't even, they wound up being like, "We don't want to work with you."
Yeah.
And then, and then he killed them?
Sure. Okay. And it didn't make him look like extra powerful. It didn't make him look I mean, I guess it made him look a little competent in terms of killing. But
I guess. But even then, because before that, the mob was so like rude and like bullying to him that it made him look really weak, and then he did kill them, so that made him look okay, maybe he's not as weak as before, so then it just neutralized it.
Yeah. I'm guessing that, you know, the director thought this was an opportunity to, like, you know, let's make a side character shine here, and you get two of them. You get the mob boss and the bodyguard.
I guess.
And, like, you know, this is the type of small character work, right, that has meaningful. So this movie felt, it had this episodic nature and this, you know, wide cast of characters as, like, Goodfellas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Goodfellas, you know, of course, is one of my favorite movies of all time. And you love seeing these just, like, little character works of, like, Paulie cutting garlic real thin in prison. And all that stuff sticks with you so much. And I think that's, like, Paulie, you know, it's somewhat of a minor-ish character in Goodfellas. And that's what, like, this mob boss was kind of supposed to be, I think. Like, a lot of gravitas and a lot of fun in these couple of scenes he has. But it wasn't. It was nothing. It was, like, nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Unnecessary. It felt like, again, something that probably is really important and interesting in the novel, that this guy felt like, because it's in the novel, it's got to be in this movie, even though I won't do justice to this. And then, it just felt like this random thing that could have so easily been cut. And same, too, with the sheriff's, like, he's sleeping around, I guess, or he's getting prostitutes or something.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I guess that did show he's, like, a dirty cop. But I would say either choose that or the gangsters and then do it right. And then, like, show us, too, that this cop is at least, like, troubled, or is he, like, so into himself that he's, like, I work for the law, and yet I can break the law, or is he like, oh my god, I hope no one sees my secrets, but it was none of that. It was just like, here's all these things he does, and he wants revenge.
Caitlin, this is like 15 minutes of our life we'll never get back. We sit on these seats.
I agree.
Why does this movie exist?
And then what else did I want to say? Oh, so like three random thoughts, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Not really even complaints. So I'll save my big complaint for the end. Number one, why did we include this in this podcast? I think we briefly mentioned this is a really weird pick for our podcast. We definitely thought it was going to be more horror than it was, or at least more
true crime.
Like there are two serial killers. I guess we could call them both serial killers. There's like a husband-wife duo. the husband seems more into it than the wife. She's like a former prostitute, maybe current.
Yeah.
And basically what they do is they find young men who are hitchhiking and they take them to the side of the road, usually near this lake, and they make the hitchhiker bang or just maybe pose with the wife while the serial killer husband takes photographs. And then they kill them and they take photographs.
Very uninteresting.
Yeah, which stinks because I would normally be super into it. It seems like a really interesting take on the serial killer. You don't normally see a serial killer character working with a wife or even being married and like sharing that side of his life with their significant other. So I thought that was, it could have been interesting, but it was, like you said, pretty boring. And again, like I said earlier, they seem like not even that evil for some reason. We were talking about this earlier, and the main serial killer character, I forget the actor's name. He is famous, though.
Is it Jason or something? I don't know. Yeah, he's been in a lot of not good horror movies, to be honest. Because I pointed him out, because he's the lead in Winchester House.
Right.
He's the lead in Salem's Lot.
Right, right. And Riley Keough is the wife.
They set up Riley Keough to be this remorseful killer.
Weird.
Someone who regrets being in this relationship. And then all of that unto the very end to have her just die. Like there's this moment where, you know, you think they can work it out or something.
Mm-hmm.
But like, why set all this up that she's remorseful where and nothing matters. There's no payoff. There's no change of heart. There's nothing at the end.
It would have been so much more interesting if they really went with that, right? Mm-hmm. That like she was really going to change and she like had this whole plan and then all that just to get killed. That would be at least dramatic. But it wasn't that. Or the other flip of this, just let her have fun and be a cool serial killer character and have her be shot at the end. That would have been awesome too.
Yeah. Well, I think they actually probably were trying to go that first route. Right? I think
they just failed at it.
They just like did set her up to try and leave, but they didn't make it clear. Again, this narrator could have stepped in and it's like, oh, she had packed her bags and this was her last kill.
Or have Tom Holland find something on her that was like, I don't know, like something on her that proved that she was gonna help him or like get out.
She was supposed to be part of the tragedy, but she ended up not being part of the tragedy.
But yeah, I bring this all up just because they had this interesting thing with like the photographing of the victims. That could have been way creepier, their Polaroid photos. I found some serial killers that this might have been based on, but I feel like that's giving this movie too much. But I'll just say like Harvey Glattman, that's who I think this is based on. He was known as the glamour girl killer who posed women and like take photos in the 50s. But again, I think that's giving this movie a little too much. And then the other thing I wanted to say, tied to that is, I think we can at least say this movie's definitely going for the Southern Gothic, so I still think it's fine that we covered this movie on our podcast. And I think that's probably why we also had some religion themes here. I think that's just part of the sort of Southern Gothic mode. You have religious extremism.
Caitlin? This is our podcast. We can cover wherever we want.
That's true. I'm just trying to make it fit in the category. And then my last little thing, I wanted to just shout out the fact that this is Robert Pattinson's third role in which he is a child molester.
Wait, so we have this one, Good Time.
I'm throwing in Twilight. He's like 100-something years old, and Bella's 17.
He's the body of a 17-year-old or whatever.
Well, I don't know. I just giving that a little shout out. Okay. Little fun trivia. But that's about it. Unfortunate. Okay. Very unfortunate.
Yeah. All right. So let's just do very quick final thoughts then. And then our final rating. What's our rating scale going to be?
Out of something. Spiders? Out of narrators?
Awful Spider-Men.
Okay. But not Tom Holland. He's a fine
Spider-Man. Tom Holland's good. I'm talking about the false prophet who got bit by a spider to make him...
Go crazy.
Terrible.
All right. Spider-Man. I just wanted to clarify. We're not coming at Tom Holland here.
No. Go ahead.
Out of 10, right? Yeah. I don't really need anything to add. I'm glad we talked it through because I think when a movie is quote-unquote soulless or quote-unquote flat, it's sometimes hard to pinpoint exactly what went wrong. Mm-hmm. So even while watching this movie, I was wondering why I didn't like it because I love the acting. And it looked good, and I generally like Southern Gothic stuff. I like serial killer stuff. So I was confused myself why I didn't like it, but I think this conversation helped pinpoint this elusive failing, all a part of this movie. So yeah, I'll just leave it at that. I will say, like a 4 out of 10 okay. Spider-Man's.
For the worst Spider-Mans in the multiverse.
Yes.
So yeah, same. None of this conversation changed my mind about any of my feelings of the movie. Same with you. It just helped reinforce the same things I was thinking. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's, if someone has 2 hours and 14 minutes to spare to watch this as part of a baseline to see what movies, like, how you can make a competent, soulless movie.
Sure.
Right?
If you're curious about that, sure.
Well, it's useful as a baseline, okay. I think. Because I haven't seen very many movies that are like this. Very many movies that, like, you can't pinpoint anything that's bad in terms of, like, objectively bad, bad acting, bad editing, or whatever. But just something that is completely soulless and something that, as a filmmaker, you should try to avoid no matter what.
Yeah.
In my opinion. So with that said, that does make it an interesting thing to view. Right?
But so long to get there.
I know. It's long. And there are times where, like, I'm actually mad that we wasted 15 minutes of our lives watching, you know,
more.
No, less.
2 hours and 15
minutes. I'm thinking of some of the most.
Oh, I see.
The most, like, pointless scenes that did absolutely nothing. So, obviously, I don't have favorable reviews for this movie. So, out of the 10 worst Spider-Mans in the multiverse, I'm going to give this a 4.3.
Mm. Yeah. And that's an interesting point. I would not recommend watching this movie unless you are into what Matt's saying here, a 2 hour whatever glimpse into soulless filmmaking. But I would recommend watching the Robert Pattinson scenes, specifically Lies and Illusions. I think that's worth checking out. You could probably find that on YouTube, and I think that's really all you need.
I think
yeah.
It's been a very interesting week watching two Netflix originals. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Many Things, and I can't even remember what this movie is.
The Devil All the Time. The Devil All the
Time. Very far ends of the spectrum in terms of, like, auteurism and soullessness.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's why I kind of almost, I don't regret watching this movie, because I got to see those ends of the spectrum so much. Anyways.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we can
that's wrap about up it. Over there. We'll do a genuine horror film next time, because I'm itching for a good horror film, especially as we are entering spooky season.
In fact, if any audience is out there, they have any suggestions of a whole entire theme for October,
yeah.
We'd be willing to take some suggestions.
Yeah. Last year we did Creepy Clowns. Yeah. And that worked out. That was a lot of fun. So yeah, if you have any ideas. I mean, I definitely still want to cover Terrifier 2 when that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
But that could be our little, like,
bonus.
Yeah, a little bonus episode. So yeah, if you have any ideas for themes, let us know.
Okay. Other than that, thank you for listening.
Bye.